Okay, so my talk, a lot of my talk is a look back at the history of this problem, but I want to start by looking back a bit further to the first calculation in quantum gravity when Planck combined the fundamental parameters, constants of quantum mechanics, special relativity, and general relativity to form in a unique way a length scale, the Planck line. And I'm starting here for a reason, but before I get to my main point. In the course of doing this, I ran across three historical asides that are sort of fun. The first is when he did this. You know, for many years, the Planck length was this exotic thing that you didn't talk about. You know, this was back in the 70s when people were working on gauge theories. And I always assumed this was something he did late in his career when he was thinking deep thoughts. But in fact, he first did this quite early, 1899, which is actually a year before the official discovery of the black body formula. So while he was in the middle of trying to make sense of all his puzzling experimental data, he had time to work out this exotic bit of gravitational physics. The second curiosity is, so you know, things are often not named for the people who first did them. And I assumed in this case, you know, nobody could have scooped Planck. But in fact, he was scooped by 25 years. Because in the mid-70s, the sizes of atoms were determined for the first time, and that made people, especially Stoney, realize that charge needs to be quantized. And so, of course, E squared over C has the same units as H bar. And so Stoney developed a system of units that were the same as Planck's except for this substitution, which means they were very close. They just differ by powers of the fine structure constant. And the third historical aside, so even though, again, Planck had this really difficult, you know, real problem with, you know, what's going on with black body radiation, real problems with data, he knew that this was important. And this is what he said about it. These units necessarily retain their meaning for all times and for all civilizations, even extraterrestrial and non-human ones, and can therefore be designated as natural units. So I like this quote because it tells you that in 100 years or more, theorists haven't changed a whole lot. But the real reason I was interested in history was to find out whether Planck had ever commented on the incredibly small size of this length. And I couldn't find that he had. But of course, because that length is so small, it suggests that important phenomena in nature are taking place at a length scale that then and even now is incredibly remote, and so there are things that are important that we will never see. And a pessimist might even go further and say, therefore, we will never understand quantum gravity, and so we shouldn't work on it. Now, certainly, I think pretty much everybody in the room would disagree with that pessimist, and the pessimist would have been wrong because, without question, you know, the effort to work on this problem has led to great things, and I think you know, there's a great feeling that great progress has been made, and that this is something that is within our reach. But what this does mean is that we're relying less than in other areas of physics on experiment and more on other things theorists do, like thought experiments. And thought experiments have played a great role in the history of theoretical physics. Galileo was, in some ways, both the first experimental physicist, but also he made effective use of thought experiments. Maxwell discovered the displacement current and the nature of light via thought experiment. Einstein, of course, did all of his elevators and mirrors and clocks and so on. And really, when you think about it, it's something that every theoretical physicist does all the time without thinking about it. In my own case, you know, discovering B-brains can very definitely be connected with a thought experiment. The question, what happens to strings if you put them in a very small box? And Stephen Hawking has provided a fantastic thought experiment, which is the subject of my talk. Now, I have to start by saying this will be an unapologetically theoretical talk. Most places I give this, the audience has a lot of experimentalists, and so I have to give that disclaimer so as to avoid being torn to pieces too quickly. Here, I don't think that's such an issue. But happily, you know, this is a problem which really interfaces the interest, I think, of all of the different groups here at BI. And so this is an especially interesting place to talk about it. So here is Hawking. So, and the nice thing, too, is that although this begins with a thought experiment, one of the several reasons that this is timely to talk about now is that this thought experiment has, in an unexpected and surprising way, finally led to the to some new understanding of real experiment. It's not the main point or the main thrust. Even more so, it has led to a much deeper understanding of the theoretical structures of physics, but it also has finally begun to impact thinking about real experiments. So here's the thought experiment. You start with infalling matter in some definite quantum state, let it collapse to a black hole, wait while the black hole evaporates, and then you make measurements in the outgoing radiation. And the experiment is not to do this once, but to do it many, many times with the same initial state and make all possible measurements on the final state. And now, what's the outcome? What do you learn from this thought experiment? So here's the same process drawn the way relativists like to, where light rays travel upwards at 45 degrees, so that in particular, here's your horizon still, your infalling matter, and anything behind the horizon is forced by causality to singularity. What happens behind the horizon stays behind the horizon. So here, this blue curve is a space-like surface on which we can talk about the state. And because the black hole geometry produces pairs, one of which tends to escape to infinity and one of which tends to fall into the singularity, we have on the indicated blue slice a very highly entangled state between the quanta outside and the quanta inside. And so if you only were making measurements on the quanta outside, you would use a density matrix, just summing over what you don't bother to observe. But at a later time, when the black hole is gone and the observer at infinity sees only empty space, not only don't you see what's inside, you can't see it. Your complete system in this universe here is just the outside quanta, and the complete description of them is a density matrix. And so Hawking's claim is that that through this thought experiment, we conclude that in the presence of gravity, pure states must evolve into mixed states. Now, and this happens with big black holes, but it should also be happening with small black holes and virtual black holes. So at some small level, it should be happening everywhere and all the time. So this is the information paradox. Of course, there's another related question with the quantum mechanics of black holes, which is that black holes satisfy thermodynamic laws. What is the and with a definite entropy, what is the corresponding statistical mechanics? And so what state does this entropy count? And they're both interesting, and the history has been linked. I'm going to focus on the paradox because, of course, a paradox is a much, much sharper and more annoying thing than a puzzle. And so as you think about this, there are a number of possible alternatives that come to mind. One is that there's alternative two. What Hawking said is right. Alternative one is that he's wrong. The state of the Hawking radiation is really pure, and the information is encoded in the Hawking radiation. Again, that there are it's a pure state. There are phases that Hawking missed. And then there are these, and I'll go through these in more detail. Now, looking at this list, there are two extreme reactions to it. One is that this set of alternatives is like angels dancing on the heads of pins. Distinguishing among these is not something you're ever going to do in practice. It's not even clear, maybe, that you can do it in principle. So maybe this is just not something that you should be thinking about wasting your time on. And the other extreme is, look, this is a challenge to the basic laws of physics. Even if it's only an experiment we can do in principle, not in practice, it's something that has to be thought about. And obviously, I'm in the second camp, although in the past there's been reason to wonder about this. But in fact, I think the second person has proven to be correct. And this has been a very, very fruitful thing to think about. So let me go through these. So the first, let me give you a different thought experiment, which is suppose you start with a system which you have coal in its ground state, 0 Kelvin, and coherent light, a laser beam, which is also in a definite state. And the light heats the coal ends up hot in what to all effects and purposes is a thermal state. It then radiates, returns to its ground state, and you have outgoing radiation, which is in all macroscopic ways thermal. But we know that since coal satisfies the ordinary rules of quantum mechanics, then since this is a pure state, this is a pure state too. It looks thermal in its coarse graining, but its exact description is in terms of a pure state. And if we did Hawking's experiment and made measurements, we would find, in fact, that the result of repeated measurements is that there is a pure state there, not a mixed state. So there's a certain set of intuitions which says, hey, if a black hole has a temperature and it radiates, it's not fundamentally any different from a piece of coal. And so the same should be true of the black hole. The Hawking radiation should be in a pure state. Hawking made a mistake, and for 30 years, people have said, Hawking made a mistake, and I am going to find it. And they failed. It's easy to confuse about oneself because there are coordinate singularities in some frames, calculate things, which seem to be, you know, large and suggest there are big corrections to Hawking's calculation. But those are really red herrings, because the basic point is simply causality. There's a big region here we can't see. And you know, if you can imagine, for example, rather than using the Hawking radiation, just by yourself forming an entangled pair of spins, throwing one in and letting one go to infinity. And once this spin passes the horizon, it is gone. Once it's inside, it's definitely not outside, and so information has been lost. There's nothing subtle about that. If it's inside, it can't also be outside. Actually, you might suppose there's some machine at the horizon that makes a quantum copy of each infalling bit, but there's a nice theorem, the no cloning or no Xerox principle, which says that, in fact, again, if you're trying to say that ordinary quantum mechanics survives, this is not consistent with quantum mechanics. You cannot make a quantum cloner. You can't make a device that takes an arbitrary state and makes a second copy of it. And this is just saying that if it works for up and it works for down, it doesn't also work for sideways. Easy to check. Okay, so if the difference between a piece of coal and a black hole is the coal doesn't have a horizon, and so there's not this causality argument that there are parts of the quantum state that are in principle unobservable. So that's why alternative one, information restoration, is unpleasant. Alternative two, I've always thought it was ugly. Again, the coal analogy really still is appealing, but the sharpest problem with information loss was pointed out by Banks, Pessin, and Susskind, and it's simply that for Hawking's kind of evolution, for evolution that takes pure states to mixed states, Noether's theorem no longer holds. There is no longer it's no longer true that symmetries imply conservation laws. And a simple way to see this is the following. So here is a model of information loss, and actually, it's under fairly broad circumstances, any system that has information loss can be modeled in this way. Imagine that we have an ordinary quantum system with a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is the sum of some various operators. But the coefficients of those operators, the couplings, are random functions of space and time. And when I mean they're random functions of space and time, I mean that they're random in the sense that you first calculate probabilities and then average, not you average after squaring, not before. That's what we mean by a random Hamiltonian. This is what a condensed matter physicist would call dirt. And so what Hawking is saying is, in effect, that space-time is dirty, which doesn't seem very appealing. But it's saying that you can model Hawking's evolution by a Hamiltonian in which the couplings are random in this way. But now, if you think about dirt, a quantum system with random disturbances, even if the average ensemble of the dirt is translationally invariant, even if there's no special point for any given Hamiltonian, you've got dirt in places you can scatter off the dirt, and so momentum is not conserved. And so this is a simple model which shows you that once you have information loss, you lose Noether's theorem, you lose energy conservation. Now, there isn't a huge literature on this. There was a challenge to it by Unruh and Wald, which I don't fully understand. One of their claims was you could tweak the parameters so that it would not have been seen, even though it happens, this energy non-conservation. Now, that doesn't seem acceptable because, after all, in general relativity, energy is a gauge charge, and you better not violate it. If you had an instantaneous change in the Schwarzschild mass of an object, the metric would change instantaneously, arbitrarily far away. And so it's even violation of energy conservation in principle is a very bad thing. There may have been some projection in which they could actually conserve energy, but I believe that projection is, again, extremely non-local. This debate wasn't carried to its conclusion, but I think it's a fairly strong argument that alternative two is not good. Alternative three was that so as the black hole radiates, it gets down to the Planck size, and part of the paradox involved assuming that it disappears completely. But maybe it, when you get to the Planck size where you don't know what's happening, you stop radiating and you have a finite size, finite mass remnant, which has a very large number of internal states, which are then correlated with the states of the outgoing Hawking radiation, so that the whole system is still pure. The problem here is, well, first of all, very small objects with enormous numbers of internal states, you know, tend not to happen in dynamical systems. Small objects tend to have small numbers of states, but even more, if you did have a light object with a number of states, which is really arbitrarily large, because you could have started with an arbitrarily large black hole, virtual production of such objects would produce unboundedly large effects. You wouldn't have physics working nicely the way it does. That's the biggest criticism. That there's a variant of this in which the information is stored in a long-lived remnant that slowly decays, and it really has the same problem. So these are sort of the natural set of alternatives that come to mind. So for about 20 years, I'd say, you'd go to seminars in this subject, and the speaker would have a new idea, and you would sort of sit there and try to figure out which of the four he or she was really talking about, and eventually it was one of the four, because you know there were different ways to think about it, it was going around the same set of circles, and was you know going around these circles for a very long time. There was a sense of how are we ever going to get out of this. And remarkably, and in a completely unexpected way, I think that we now do know what the answer is. By the way, I won't dwell on this, but you know, I've been talking about the horizon, the point of no return. You know, you might ask, what about the singularity? You know, what happens there? The gravity breaks down. Anything could happen. It could be an end of time, you know, just an end, which is actually what I believe is true. But you could instead imagine that when you know the correct theory, a baby universe breaks off. Or you could imagine that, again, you enter a region of Planckian geometry, and there's a new bit of space-time, which rather than breaking off, actually reconnects to the exterior. I think this is what Ashtekar and Bojewald have been recently saying. And you know, thinking about the singularity doesn't actually give you new alternatives. It ends up just putting you in one or the other of the original choices. This is what you would call a long-lived remnant, because there is an observer here who sees a Planck-sized object. The strong gravity doesn't appear until the horizon is Planck-sized. So there's an observer here who sees a Planck-sized object. All essentially the Hawking radiation has passed out. And is still incoherent, so it is being correlated with these later Ashtekar-Bojewald photons, and it means this state is a long-lived remnant, a small object with many internal states. So thinking about singularity actually just takes you through the same circles that you already were going through. Now, yes.
argue about it later, but the outcome where either this one or that one, my understanding is that your case against them rests on the possibility of making virtual pairs of such things?
You mean the remnants?
Your claim is that these are like remnants and therefore you can make virtual pairs.
Right.
That's something that would have to be shown in a detailed theory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these were, absolutely. I mean, you don't have any, right. I mean, when you do these thought experiments, you don't have a detailed theory, or at least, you don't have a detailed theory. I'll come back to this point.
Okay.
But you're simply trying to ask, you know, given what we know about quantum physics, if this is the alternative, what do we give up? And certainly, if you have enough, you know, pair production of a quantum theory that has objects that can't be pair produced is hard to imagine. Let me leave it at that. Anyway. Right, no, you know, you could, again, there was a long period of trying to fix these problems. But the answer is obtained not really by trying to fix the problems directly, but through a more circuitous route. Okay, so the first sort of bit of progress, if you can call it that, I would say is black hole complementarity, which isn't so much a solution as a scenario, which is, okay, so this is the picture which I said is impossible because you can't make a quantum Xerox machine, you can't have a bit which is both here and here, or rather you can't have two bits which are always in the same state, no matter what axis you measure along. What Susskind said, in effect, is this is the right picture, but you're interpreting the wrong way. This is one bit, but you can't tell where it is. So it is a very, very large violation of locality. You know, the starting point for these arguments is gravity is a low energy effective theory. On this slice here, curvatures are small. You think that canonical quantization of gravity should be a good description of the long-range physics, the black hole size physics. And canonical quantization says that these states are one Hilbert space, and these states are totally different. They're not the same. And what Susskind is saying is something very radical, that canonical quantization is way, way off, and these states are the same state. So this was not, again, so much a solution, but what it is it shows you how radical a solution has to be. It's not a small tweak on gravity's low energy effective field theory. It's a completely different and starting point, moreover, in which locality is seemingly not manifest. Tuft came to the same conclusion in an entirely different way. He was thinking more about the puzzle than the paradox, and said, look, in most systems, the entropy never degrees of freedom goes as the volume. If for a black hole, the entropy goes as the surface area, then we should think about the states of a quantum gravitating system, not in terms of variables which are local in the volume, but holographic variables which are local on the boundary, sort of a Planckian density of them on the black hole horizon. Again, it's a scenario. It's something that you can hear and it sounds poetic, but you don't know whether to believe it or not. So in terms of serious progress, so coming back to the puzzle, Horowitz and Strominger argued that there was at least one situation in which you could make a precise statement about the statistical mechanics of black holes. For string theory and supersymmetric backgrounds, you have the freedom to adiabatically change the coupling constant. You can reduce it, and if you reduce it enough, a black hole ceases to be black, and depending on what charges it has, what kind of black hole, it becomes some weakly gravitating ordinary quantum mechanical system. And in some cases, you can actually count this. You have an explicit Hamiltonian over here. You can count the states, and wow, it worked. So good. So this is the sort of this is the entropy puzzle and one solution to it. Now, that's the puzzle. Motivated though by the information paradox, people started looking not just at the number of states, the entropy, but the dynamical properties. When you hit the system, how does it radiate? You know, what happens to the information? And start to find these really puzzling coincidences. So you would do a calculation in field theory. You would calculate something which could be a complicated high-loop Feynman graph. That was the calculation in the brain gas. You do a calculation in gravity, gravitons propagating in curved space. And these very different calculations would often give the same answer. And that was a real puzzle for a couple of years, which Maldacena crystallized as a new duality. Statement that okay, so if you take the this adiabatic continuation of Horowitz and of Bopfett and Strominger and take the low energy limit on the black hole side, you get the region of high redshift, the near horizon geometry, which is ADS5 cross S5 anti de Sitter space in a sphere. On the D brain side, you get the degrees of freedom of the D brain system, low energy of freedom or gauge theory. And so if this diagram commutes, then you have this new duality where these are the same system written into very different sets of variables. That's a radical claim that a four-dimensional quantum field theory could be the same as a 10-dimensional string theory, but it explains the coincidences of calculation and many, many other things. You know, you would think there'd be many more states over here. Got strings in 10 dimensions, but in fact, you can count the states in various ways, and they match up. So, okay, there were so you know, we had dualities between quantum field theories and quantum field theories, string theories and string theories, and here's a duality between quantum field theory and string theory, which is especially remarkable and puzzling. There are dualities. The Ising model, high low temperature, and bosonization, dualities in 1+1 dimensions, and free theories in higher dimensions, where you can, you know, go from one side to the other directly. Here, in all of these, even the quantum field theory dualities, beyond the simplest ones, the evidence is still circumstantial. It's incredibly strong, but circumstantial. I think it's remarkable that, you know, we make such use of these things and can't prove them. Hopefully this is a sign that there is some deep and powerful concept that we have yet to discover that will explain these that we haven't found yet. But in any case, so this duality, as I'll sort of go on to illustrate, is I think our deepest understanding about the theoretical structures underlying nature. And it's really a direct descendant, there's a C in there, a direct descendant of the information paradox. You know, most particle physicists, most string theorists started out as particle theorists. And so for us, black holes were these strange and exotic things. Nowadays, everything is black holes, and it's all anybody thinks about. But, you know, early on, these were these exotic things, and it wasn't obviously the right thing to think about. And it was only Hawking's annoying claim that these things, you know, violated the laws of quantum mechanics that made it impossible to ignore them. And, you know, this 2-year period between Strominger, Vafa, and Maldacena really was a time when, you know, there was tremendous effort focused on this and this puzzlement about these things that were agreeing. And you know, the reason people worked so hard and thought so hard about that is because of Hawking's annoying claim. And it's easy to imagine that without Hawking's thought experiment, we would still not know about this duality. So let me explain why this duality is so important. So when you have a duality, when you have the same quantum system written in different sets of variables, you learn things in both directions. You learn things about gravity and string theory from what you know about gauge theory, and in the other direction. So let me first take it this way. So this provides, really for the first time, an algorithmic construction of quantum gravity, although in a specific circumstance, in an anti de Sitter box. Let me actually go through them in detail. So here's the box, anti de Sitter space. I should say of string theory, just to. And why I say it's algorithmic is because we could simulate the dual gauge theory on a sufficiently large computer and thereby calculate any transition amplitude in this theory. In the history of quantum field theory, you know, quantum field theory went through a long period of development, similar to the development of string theory, where for a long time it was just a perturbation theory. And it was really Ken Wilson who first asked in a systematic way, what was it beyond perturbation theory? And he felt he would know the answer if he had an algorithmic way to calculate, even if he didn't have a big enough computer. And it was, I mean, this way of thinking about things led him to, you know, great conceptual advances in quantum field theory. And I would say that this is the corresponding conceptual advance for string theory. Again, it's almost background independent in the sense the metric is emergent and completely unspecified in the interior. A lot can happen inside. The boundary is still nailed down. But one of the things that can happen inside is that you can form a black hole and carry out Hawking's thought experiment. And since this all can be translated into the boundary gauge theory, which is completely quantum mechanical and well-defined, you know that a pure state evolves to a pure state. Well, this is satisfying at several levels. First of all, there was a set of intuitions that said if a black hole radiates and has a temperature, then it's not that different from a lump of coal or a hot plasma. And in fact, in this context, they are the same thing in different variables. A black hole is, in its dual description, just a ball of hot gas. Also, as anticipated by Susskind and Tuft, the gauge theory variables are strongly non-local and do indeed sort of live holographically on the boundary of the space in which gravity lives. So the paradox led to the discovery of this duality. In turn, this duality seems to have resolved the paradox. Now, for me, this is not the important thing. The important thing is the broader lesson it's taught us about gravity and gauge theory being different classical limits of a single quantum system. I think it's a much deeper point. The information problem is a means to an end. Okay. So in turn, in the other direction, using what we know about string theory and gravity, anti de Sitter, so the duality can allow us to calculate things we couldn't previously calculate. So I told you about these coincidences. These coincidences, in retrospect, were for certain special quantities to which only a single Feynman graph contributes. It could be a very complicated Feynman graph, but basically just one. For typical quantities, you have an infinite sum of Feynman graphs. You have no idea how to proceed if the coupling is strong. And this allows you to do calculations. So just from the point of view of quantum field theory, this is a fantastic thing. And it seems to have applications. So at RIC, they are colliding gold nuclei, nicely Lorentz contracted, to make a new state of matter that they used to call a quark gluon plasma, now a quark gluon liquid. Here's the same thing, a space-time picture of the same process. It's interesting. Over a period of years, they seem to have a much more concrete picture of the series of events that are involved in one of these collisions, a period of isotropization, thermalization, this quark gluon plasma liquid or liquid phase, and then hot hadrons, and then free hadrons. And it's this phase which is the one that's in question here. And so insights from the black hole dual, the dual description of a strongly coupled theory. So one hears a lot about the ratio of the shear viscosity to the entropy density. Actually, both numbers are independently interesting, and both of them one learns interesting things about from the dual description. In fact, there's a fundamental question for these collisions, which is the plasma that one produces weakly or strongly coupled? And the problem is that you don't really know a lot about strongly coupled non-equilibrium gauge theories to, you know, relate to. So with the ADS-CFT duality, you have a means of doing calculations in such theories, not in the theory you really want to do, not in QCD, But it turns out that the most distinctive differences, the supersymmetry, the conformal symmetry, are uninteresting at high temperature. And it turns out that what you get is qualitatively and even quantitatively interesting. I like the black hole is, in effect, a harmonic oscillator for solenoid coupled non-equilibrium gauge theories. That is, you know, the harmonic oscillator is something you can solve, and you hope that you have a system that is similar to it, but it never is exactly a harmonic oscillator. The n equals 4 gauge theory is something that you can solve, and happily, you learn things from it that are relevant to the real system. And actually, there's been a series of successive applications. The most recent has been the understanding of these. So in the phenomenology, a big part of it is the running of hydrodynamic codes. So there's periods here that need to be understood and here as well. But the big part of it is running of hydrodynamic codes and comparing with the observed pattern of outflowing particles. And this has required an improvement in the state of the art in relativistic hydrodynamics, the inclusion of higher order terms in a systematic way, and having a solvable model in which you can test these improved theories has been enormously valuable. And so it's gratifying to see that you know, that this fantastic result in quantum field theory is actually practically useful. Most recently, there may also be condensed matter applications. In condensed matter, there are a lot of you know, strongly coupled critical systems, and they can tailor the Hamiltonian to a much greater extent. And so this is likely to be a new frontier. Now, I just want to sort of express an opinion here. So is Rick really making a black hole? Well, of course not. It's just smashing together a bunch of protons and neutrons and making a gas of quarks and gluons. But from another point of view, what duality tells you is that distinctions that we make with our classical experience are not always absolute distinctions. The distinction between waves and particles was not an absolute distinction. And here we have a single quantum system. One limit is a gauge theory. One limit is gravity. So similarly, there is not such an absolute distinction between black holes and quark-gluon plasmas. You can imagine a series of theories. The change from one to the next is very small. And there is no sharp place where things change. But in one extreme, you would definitely have an object you would call the black hole. And in the other extreme, you would definitely have an object you would definitely call a quark-gluon plasma. So this is I think this is a more subtle question than you might think. OK, so this is the past and the present, now the future. So if you were making a list of the problems of quantum gravity, or if I were making such a list, this is what I'd start with: the ultraviolet problem, the cosmological constant, black hole entropy information, and then a variety of cosmological problems, singularities, the initial condition, which may or may not be the same problem, and the interpretation of quantum mechanics applied to the whole universe. And say 25 years ago, so I focus on one, the information problem. I've told you how we went through a period of tremendous confusion and have passed to what I think is a period of understanding. 25 years ago, I would say all of these were complete mysteries. It was hard to imagine how you would get traction on any of them. And now I would claim that for a number of them, on the same level as I've told you for the information problem, we now know the answer. Now, I made this slide knowing that it would infuriate people. And having used it a few times, I can report that I succeeded. Because certainly not everybody agrees that these problems are solved. Even among string theorists, this is far from unanimous on many points. Certainly for all of these, and especially for the I'm focusing on the one, for all of these, there are open and interesting questions. I'm just telling you my own assessment of the evidence, and so that the frontier, the next questions are cosmological. Now, string theory has provided some prod to the cosmology by providing a microphysics in which eternal inflation can take place. Now, eternal inflation is an old idea. And there are long-standing conceptual questions. String theory has simply reawakened them, again, by providing a microphysics in which they're relevant. If string theory is as good as those string theorists say, then it should do more than this. It should provide real resolutions to some of the deep conceptual questions of cosmology. And certainly, I hope to add a few more check marks to the list. But again, the question is, how do you get traction on these cosmological questions? And there certainly are various direct attacks, especially on the measure for eternal inflation, how you talk about measurement in that context. But there's enough people doing that. I actually see the question as a different one. Again, for me, it's very important that ADS-CFT provides an algorithmic construction of string theory in a box, and very differently, a box with non-cosmological boundary conditions. You could try to torture the theory and make it do cosmological things inside the box, but it's pretty much a stretch. If you've got boundary conditions at finite distance, you don't have cosmology. The universe isn't free to do what it wants to do. And so, you know, I believe that the way to make progress on these deep questions is in part to figure out how the lessons of ADS-CFT extend to cosmological situations, how one would give a precise definition of string theory, an algorithmic definition in a cosmological situation. And I've come around, partly due to the prodding of Steve Giddings, to thinking that one route to this might be to go back to some of the unsolved issues in the problem that I've been talking about, black hole information. In particular, after all, black holes do have horizons and singularities like space-time, and so likely there is some further lesson there. So the question is how to proceed. Haven't we solved the problem? And that's what we haven't. Let me just tell you what we haven't solved. So one question is, where was Hawking's mistake? Now, I should say that at the deepest level, Hawking made no mistake. Hawking's great insight was this was a real paradox that everybody should think about. And he was right about that. When I say Hawking's mistake, I mean if the information does come out, what was wrong with his argument? And to the best of anybody's knowledge, there was nothing wrong with his argument. So here's a picture I used earlier, the entangled state between the inside and the outside. And it's important that you can imagine a series of times, these blue slices, which are both late enough that most of the radiation, most of the photons have been emitted, and yet early enough that you're not, the black hole is still large compared to the Planck scale, so curvatures are still small. So on such a time slice, curvatures are small. You believe that you can use quantum gravity as a low energy effective field theory. And what it tells you is what I told you earlier, that there's an entangled state. And as Page showed, once you have more than half of the photons coming out, if the state is still as I've drawn it, entangled between the interior and the exterior, and not somehow with this information re-radiated, once you get to this point, you're doomed. You can never recover the information within the Hawking radiation. So this is Hawking's original argument, and it still is perfectly correct. And so if his conclusion was wrong, then somehow his assumptions were wrong. He used low energy quantum gravity, if gravity is an effective field theory, beyond its range of validity, and how exactly, where did it stop being valid, and how did it stop being valid? And, here we are. So there's another way to think about this question, which is the following. So I told you that if we do Hawking's thought experiment in an ADS box, a pure state evolves to a pure state. So the theory, just you start with your infolding matter. You translate via the for a diffuse state of infolding matter, one can translate into a state in the gauge theory. You can evolve this and forward in principle numerically, and then translate back. And so there is your calculation of the black hole S matrix, the pure state to pure state mapping. And what I'm saying is that if you did try to do the calculation directly, which is what Hawking did, you get a different answer. The picture doesn't commute. And so this is another, so this is a paradox which is maybe as sharp, I'm not sure whether it's as sharp and annoying as the original paradox, but certainly from the point of view of the ADS as the solution to this problem, it is a sharp and annoying paradox. Now, ADS-CFT duality is still a black box. I told you we can't derive it, and so you can't start here and kind of creep over to here and figure out where the mistake was made, because we don't have the interior, we don't have the connection. And so I think it's a useful exercise to look at, well, one way to try to approach this is to look at simpler toy models, which don't have the full, question, yes?
If that diagram commutes, isn't that equivalent to saying there really is not a singularity in the bulk? For every initial set state that will collapse to a black hole.
You know, it's interesting because the singularity doesn't enter much. Well, I mean, I'm not sure that the singularity doesn't enter much into the discussion, because independent of what happens at the singularity, once you have the horizon, you know, let me actually revert a slide. Or two or three. Oops. You know, the paradox appears on this blue slice. It doesn't matter what happens to singularity. The paradox, once you get to the blue slice, you've got the diagram not commuting. So that's why I say I think the issue is one of the horizon, not the singularity.
But just to be provocative, if you believed in the Ashtekar-Bolotov picture, your diagram would easily commute.
No, okay, okay, good, 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 good. Thank you. This is a good point. So the Ashtekar-Bolotov picture, as I said, is a remnant picture. And so how do we know if the information, so good. How do we know that the pure state to pure state is really taking place through alternative one, where the information escapes with the Hawking radiation, and not alternative four, where you have the, where you first have incoherent Hawking radiation, and then you have this later Ashtekar-Bolotov radiation, which is entangled with it, so that the whole state is pure. Well, that requires at intermediate times that there be this remnant, this Planck-sized object and Planck-massed object with an unboundedly large number of states. And you can, I would say you can prove, this is if you, you know, not easy to prove things in quantum field theory, but I think you can prove this much, that below a given energy, the number of states is bounded in a pretty simple way. And you cannot have remnants. You cannot have the enormous number of states that a remnant scenario, including Ashtekar-Bolotov walls, would have. Yeah. So I thought you were going to ask me a different provocative question, which is, if the diagram doesn't commute, then maybe it's showing us that ADS-CFT is wrong, since this bit of the calculation is ADS-CFT. And of course, every time you use this duality, you have the chance of finding a nonsense result that would tell you that the duality is wrong, and so far it has survived. Here's an especially provocative way of testing it. And the reason that I think the mistake is here is that, again, there were these pre-existing reasons for doubting it, namely the Banks, Peskin, Suskin argument, and just the general intuition that the ordinary laws that a black hole isn't that different from any other hot object. But the specific, most striking technical problem is the Banks, Peskin, Suskin problem. Of course, one way to, it's important to set both the status. There are still many points of view on this subject. I will proudly stand by my check, but there are still many points of view on this subject. And certainly one way, the only way to satisfy people is to find, if in fact Hawking made a mistake, is to find it. And so one way to approach, one way to approach this is to look for a simpler toy model which retains some of, as many as possible of, the key features of this system, and yet still has paradox. And so here's a toy model. So there's a series of steps, but this is motivated by some work of Hong Liu and Guido Festuccia. And so the gauge theory on the boundary of ADS space on the three sphere is an infinite number of coupled modes, each of which is an n by n matrix. And Festucci and Liu argued that you could still see the information paradox. You could still see the black hole horizon and the information paradox, even by reducing the system to one that has, instead of an infinite number of coupled modes, just two coupled modes, two matrices. Now, I should say, you lose a lot. You no longer have a clean space-time interpretation on the gravity side. But what you retain is the basic structure, as I'll say in a little bit, of the gravitational loop expansion. Now, their model wasn't quite simple enough, so we reduced it to one matrix and one vector, so n squared plus n harmonic oscillators with the simplest possible Hamiltonian you can imagine. Harmonic oscillators terms for the this is quantum mechanics. You know, ADS space, you have time and a bounded space, and so you really have just time. So harmonic oscillators, and a UN invariant coupling. And I claim that simple as this model is, it retains at least some of the key features of black holes and of the information problem. So which ones does it retain? OK, so it retains the information problem in Maldacena's form. So after this ADS, discussions of black holes that form and then decay is messy. It's easy to think about eternal black holes. So ADS-CFT is gravity in a box. And any quantum system in a box should have a discrete spectrum, a finite number of states below any given energy. And indeed, that's what the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is saying. It's finite. The puzzle is that if you try to do quantization of gravity as a low energy effective field theory in this box, you get an infinite number of states. You get a continuous spectrum. And that's, again, because if you have a horizon, you have a pileup of modes. In one coordinate system, you have a pileup of modes at the horizon. If you quantize canonically, you find a continuous spectrum. And you can quantify that in terms of, for example, two-point functions and their behavior, their spectral representation. And this model captures this in the same sense. So the the canonical quantization of gravity, the lowest order in sort of gravitational loop expansion, is analogous to, in ADS-CFT duality, the leading large n approximation, the planar approximation to the gauge theory. And so this toy model retains that structure. It retains the structure of having a 1 over n approximation, which is the dual of the gravitational loop expansion. And it does capture this property that in the planar limit, the canonical gravity limit, it has a continuous spectrum, and it can't have it in the exact theory. So this is a fun theory to play with. The ADS-CFT duality, a lot of the work happens on the gravity side. But here, I really am trying to look inside the gauge theory, Feynman graphs. And this toy model is especially sort of nice and tractable because it only has one interaction, an interaction between the one index fundamental field and the two index adjoint field, matrix field. And in the limit of planar graphs, you can sum them. This index form was first found by Tuft in two-dimensional QCD. And I think there's a large class of models that could be solved and haven't been solved, which have the same graphical structure. Anyway, we're using this. One of them, you can write the Springer-Dyson equation, which has, it's an integral equation. It's a closed equation for the propagator of the fundamental field. Basically, in this model, if you want to think about it, in this model, the matrix degrees of freedom, the n squared degrees of freedom, are like the black hole. And the fundamental is like you've moved a little D-brain near the black hole, and you're studying how the black hole affects the quantum degrees of freedom of this probe. Those are the fundamentals. And so you're calculating here the natural object, the two-point function of the probe degrees of freedom. And anyway, what I'm saying is you can reduce the integral equation, which you can do the integral, reduce it to a recursion relation. It's a lot of fun. And I could give a whole talk just about these integral equations, but I would bore everybody. But it does have the property that you need. That is, the goal. So in order for the toy model to capture this paradox, it needs to have the property that in the planar limit, it has a continuous spectrum. That's again the thing that canonical gravity has that the real black hole can't have. And it does. This is the spectral density, and what you see, we had to do it numerically. And what you see is that indeed the spectral density is not isolated. Delta functions is zero, but fills out even at low temperature, but especially at high temperature, continuous ranges of energy. So this model, again, you know, with any toy model, there's always the question: have you kept enough to learn something? And it's not clear yet, but you know, I think that this model has a lot in it. In particular, I think one can use it to address in a sharp way. Maldacena proposed that the resolution involved the fact that there were other saddle points with a very small weight that provided the small corrections that one needed to close the diagram to make it compute. And I've never believed that because they seem to be small in all bases, whereas the change that you need is large in some bases. And this point was made by Barbone and Rabinovich. I won't go into the details. I think one can make it more sharply in this model that in fact, maybe in some modified form, but simply the Maldacena's claim that Hawking had just overlooked some saddle points in the gravitational path integral, I don't believe. And I think in this model, one can sharpen that disbelief. You know, this model is so simple, what survives? So there's a thing called the stringy exclusion principle where, so when you quantize, let's take the 5 sphere of ADS5 process 5. When you quantize gravity and you got that 5 sphere, you might think that you sort of have spherical harmonics up to arbitrarily high momentum, an infinite number of states, whereas the duality actually bounds this. It bounds the energy by some power of n. And so there's this thing that has been called the stringy exclusion principle, where string theory reduces the size of the Hilbert space of canonical gravity in a way that's understood in some examples, but not others. And that, in some sense, is what one is looking for. The spectrum of canonical gravity is much too large in this system, and one is looking for the right Hilbert space. So this is the conjecture. This is new, and I believe that by beating on this model further, we can learn more about the problem. Okay, so in conclusion, so Don Page showed, I mentioned earlier, that if the information is emitted with the Hawking radiation, it starts coming out after about half the radiation is emitted. And I should mention before my conclusion something I didn't have time to talk about, but a very recent interesting paper by Hayden and Preskill, you know, using insights from quantum information, having to do with the question of if the information comes out, how fast does it come out? And they've argued that in some circumstances, it come out extraordinarily fast, not in the lifetime of the whole black hole, but in a much shorter, this is all in Planck units, that's why it's different units, but in a much shorter time. It's a very interesting insight, and I think it really challenges some of the pictures of how the information escapes. Anyway, that's an aside. But Page argued that the black hole emits for a while, but the information only starts coming out at about the halfway point. And I think that's a good metaphor for the information problem itself, because Hawking found the problem in 1976. And for a long time, a lot of effort went in, and nothing came out. And then with the black hole complementarity and holography, things started coming out, and with ADS-CF duality, more came out. But I don't think the problem has decayed completely. I think there's still more information to be learned from it. So thank you.
Something I understand is that, so if a black hole is propagated by a thermal state, right, in this,
yes.
So the terminal state is a stationary state. It's not going to evolve into anything else, no?
Well, a black hole in an ambient space is not really a thermal state because it's not in equilibrium with the external degrees of freedom. Now, the nice thing about putting a black hole in a box, and by the way, even if we're black holes in flat space-time, I think it's interesting to think about putting a mirrored shell around it, which is very similar to what ADS does. And so the black hole in ADS space, since the ADS in effect reflects all the radiation back, can be in a thermal state. And that black hole is eternal, so it is stationary.
Does not evaporate in ADS.
It's not evaporating ADS. And therefore, that's why that's, you can actually, well, it's not evaporating ADS. And Maldacena argued that the information problem could be recast and probably is most nicely discussed not for black holes that form and evaporate, but for eternal black holes. And it's again the question that that if you calculate some two-point function, you kick the system here, you measure the vibration later, then if you do this in, because there's a horizon here, the longer you wait, the smaller the amplitude that you hear, because the longer you wait, the more probability that the degrees of freedom have fallen through the horizon. In a system with a finite number of degrees of freedom, that can't happen. Because you simply have a finite number of sines and cosines added up. It can look like an exponential for a while, and then it begins to oscillate in a random way. And so a nice reformulation of the information problem, which is relevant to eternal black holes in a box, is why does the low energy calculation, which says that the longer you wait, the less you see, break down?
Yes, John? From what I understand, there must be half a dozen or more proposals for resolving the information loss paradox. Some of these claim that there's no information loss problem, others claim there is. And in the history of physics, important thought experiments led to experimental confirmation of the theory of themselves. So my question is, can we expect the medical thought experiment to be resolved with pure theory? Ever.
Well, let me answer that at two levels. First, a general level, and then a specific one. Thought experiments are useful because the main reason thought experiments are useful is they're used for killing dead ideas. If you have an idea, you do a thought experiment, and you quickly find it leads to nonsense, and you go on to your next idea. But sometimes your idea leads to nonsense, or what seems to be nonsense, maybe the nonsense is true. And those are especially fruitful. That's what Hawking did. So Hawking's thought experiment led to something which, from one point of view, is nonsense, but you couldn't prove it's nonsense, so it was fruitful. Now, in terms of connecting with real experiment, I would say that, again, in this unexpected way, well, this talk would not be worth giving if there hadn't been some fruit in paradox. And the fruit is theoretical. The fruit is this still theoretical connection between gauge theory and gravity. So, you know, I would say that, no, here's a demonstration that a thought experiment can have value, even if the value is purely theoretical. But in this case, in fact, as I told you, this duality is being used to study real experiments. So, you know, it doesn't prove that the theory of quantum gravity, which is being used to analyze the collisions at RIP, is the same one that's functioning out there. You can't do that with just a thought experiment, but we've learned a lot from it.
Question? I understand that Hawking conceded that he was wrong in this conjecture. And I was wondering if you can explain what actually triggered his concession.
Yes, I can tell you what triggered it, but I think he conceded for the wrong reason. So I mean, I think he finds the ADS-CFT argument convincing. But in terms of where he made his original mistake, he believes this argument that Maldacena's about additional saddle points. I think you can see psychologically why he would believe that. It's a Euclidean argument. It's an argument based on Euclidean saddle points. And he has this conviction that gravity should start from a Euclidean description. So this, but again, I don't believe Maldacena's argument, so I think that Hawking conceded for the wrong reason, because you're looking for an effect which is small in some bases and large in others. And this is an effect which is small in all bases. So basically, this is the argument, that he believes that he didn't include all the relevant saddle points in the Euclidean category.
Okay.
So you had a check mark that had a lot of problems.
That's the one that always makes everybody angry. Well, they all do. But yeah. So I have a slide for that one. Of course not. But yes.
Yes.
It's my talk and it's my choice. So this is a quote from Weinberg's famous review of the problem in 1989. It's actually the last sentence from the review, so I think one could say he was giving a special emphasis. Finally, in a great instance of astronomy, if it is only anthropic constraints that keep the effective cosmological constant within empirical limits, then this constant should be rather large enough to show up before long in astronomical observations. That was in 1989, and 8 years later it did show up, to the great surprise of everyone except Weinberg and those of us who had studied his paper. Since that time, the evidence continues to pile up that it's a cosmological constant and not some other something else. And at the same time, string theory has, it wasn't obvious then, but string theory has provided a microphysics in which Weinberg's mechanism can work. That is a microphysics in which there are many, many potential vacua with a fine-grained spectrum of possible values of the cosmological constant, and a mechanism for populating them all so that anthropic selection, there might be other selections operating as well, but so that anthropic selection in particular can operate. So this is my reading of the evidence and why I give it the check mark.
You made the very nice comparison with the thought experiments. I think thought experiments, you have to be a bit lucky, because when Galileo said, I cannot tell with local experiments if the ship is moving or not, he wasn't sure. He wasn't 100% sure. He said, my feeling is that you cannot, okay?
Yeah.
So are you 100% sure that the
No, I'm not 100% sure of anything. Absolutely. No, I said this is my reading of the evidence. And, it's good to reflect on the value of thought experiments, because again, sometimes they give you results which are so nonsensical you know you got the wrong theory. But sometimes, and here's a really classic case where they tell you that something strange has to happen, and it might be a very, very long time before you know which of the strange alternatives it is.
Right. Any last questions? Yes.
Can I be devil's advocate here for a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. So when I was a grad student in Texas, I went to Weinberg and I asked for comments. They looked at me and he said, "You're too young to worry about anthropic arguments. You should be out there looking for clever solutions."
Yes.
So, does putting a check mark next to it, if it's referring to an anthropic explanation, represent a solution or a concession?
Okay, well, I'll make two comments there. The first comment is that Hawking did the world a great favor by infuriating everybody, you know, with this claim about information loss. And so if I succeed in infuriating people, I hope it's similarly fruitful. The second claim is that no young person should be allowed to believe in the anthropic principle until they've made at least one wrong theory of the cosmological concept. So I do.
I can put a check mark next to that.
Very good. Any last question? Very good. Well, Joe is around till Friday morning. We look forward to his talk tomorrow. And Steve Chinaman, thank you very much.